Welcome back. This is Dr. K in for Mark Steiner here on your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. 4 years ago, on February 26, Trayvon Martin was fatally shot by George Zimmerman. He was unarmed, he was black, walking home, wearing a hoodie at night. His murder in many ways gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement, which has reframed the way Americans, both black and white and brown, think about and talk about police treatment of people of color. Since then, we've had countless incidents of unarmed black men and women, boys and girls from Eric Garner to Tamir Rice and on, being killed by rogue police officers and would-be vigilantes. It has also changed the way that families are talking about race. As we start getting prepared for this upcoming school year, we have our parenting roundtable today to discuss parenting in the age of Black Lives Matter. How should we talk to our kids about race, and how can we keep them safe? Joining me in studio is Dr. Lamar Darnell Shills, co-founder and senior director of education and innovation at the Cambio Group, founder of Praise College Readiness Program, a Baltimore social innovator, and he's the author of What I Learned in the Midst of Chaos, The Making of an Ubuntu Teacher. Is that correct?
That's great. That was a great South African accent right there.
I've been working on it. And by phone, we have Dr. Marie Nubia Feliciano. She's a professor of College of Educational Studies at Chapman University. Good morning, Marie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. And we have Shamara Arki. She's an educator, an activist, an organizer, a doctoral student at Northeastern University, and her research focuses on mother work in the age of Black Lives Matter. Good morning. How are you, Shamara?
I'm well, Dr. K. Thank you for having me.
Good. Let me ask everyone just off the top. Shamara, how many children do you have, boys or girls? What do you have?
I have two sons. My oldest son is 9. His name is Solomon Safari. And I have a younger son who's 6. His name is Malcolm Sadiq.
Okay, Lamar, do you have children?
Strong name, sister.
Very strong name.
Wow, my son, Mosiah Sekou, and then he is 9. He is 9 as well. I think he's 99. My middle daughter, Samira Nafia, and then Hadia, who was 14, who attends a boarding school here in Baltimore. So three amazing young
people. Yeah. And how about Marie? Do you have children?
I do. I have an older son who's 10 and a half, and I have a daughter who's 9.
Okay, good. I wanted to put that out and frame it because, as people know, I have two boys. I have a 15-year-old who's going on 25, and I have a 13-year-old who I believe is going on 65. So this conversation with this parenting roundtable, I think, is based upon, for all of us, both our research, which I call me-search, because anything into my kids is me-search, but also from personal lived experience. So we're talking from both of those perspectives. We want people to call us. If they have questions about raising their children, how do you keep them safe? How do you talk about race? We want to hear about it today at 410-319-8888. So let's just start with Shamara. How do you talk to your kids about race? How do you frame that conversation?
You know, that has been an ongoing conversation that I've been having with my children pretty much since they've been about 3.
Wow.
Explain to them around who we are as black people in America and how other people see them. I want my children to really understand that our home is a place of love and acceptance. But when you step outside those doors, it's a little bit different. And it's troubling for me as a mother to prepare my 6-year-old to go to the park where, you know, right here, 12 miles from our home is where Tamir was shot.
Oh, wow.
So I have to talk to my son about going to the park, and if you see something that doesn't look right at the park, come home. And I have to tell them which houses are safe in the neighborhood. I have to tell them which houses they can go inside and play, because I know those moms and those parents, and which are not so safe that they shouldn't go inside of. So it's something that I think about on a very theoretical level all the time, because like you talked about, the research is me-search, but then I have to make it plain for my 6-year-old in order to keep him safe.
Well, let me come to you, Marie, next. How about you? How do you talk to your kids about race? When did you start having that conversation?
I teach race and the valuing difference in American society at Chapman, and so we talk around the dinner table about the things that I talk about in class, and it is about forming a racialized identity, whatever your ethnic or racial background is, and so we have those conversations around the table. But I'm in a unique situation where I'm an Afro-Puerto Rican woman, and so I have a Latina identity. I present to the world as a black woman, but the interpretations of what society does back to me is filtered through that Latina consciousness. And so I've had to learn what it means to be Black in the United States, because it's different to what it means to be a Black Latina in Puerto Rico. And so I'm married to a Dutch man, and both of my children could pass for not Black. Mm-hmm. They could, you know, and so the conversations that we have around the table about a race really have to do with how I navigate through the world, how they need to be aware of how the world responds to me, because they're going to respond to them differently. Like, for instance, my daughter had a fit, like most children do at Target, when something doesn't happen the way they want it to. And I started to reprimand her like any regular parent would. And I started to draw a crowd. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I realized my Black skin screaming to a child that can pass for white is being seen as suspect. So I had to walk over to my husband and tell him, I'm going to take our son, and I'm going to go to another part of the store. You need to deal with her. And he did, because I didn't know what was going to happen next. And so those are the types of conversations. Then on the way home, we talked about it, and we did a little debrief around the dinner table. But it's a very, for me, it's sort of moving into and out of three different worlds constantly, and having to figure out what kind of words to use that are age appropriate for my children is a really difficult task.
And then, Lamar, I want to come to you as we're opening up this conversation. With your 9-year-old son, I'm sure that the conversation with him is probably different from your 14-year-old daughter. I mean, I'm just making that assumption. I want you to tell me, is it a different conversation with boys and girls? And when did you start having
this
conversation?
It's interesting. We have a Boricua también, chica. Buenos días. Boricua. Chevare. You know, it's interesting listening to these conversations, these two amazing sisters on the line. There's so many similarities. I wish I had the conversation of my then 7-year-old son, Mosiah, with his cousin, Messiah, in the backseat of my car. They sound like two old men. They were talking about Ruby Bridges. And I sent it to Mark Steiner maybe a year ago. And it just, you know, it went viral because it was two guys. Every time these two young brothers get together, they sound like two old men. So I always pull out my phone to record them. And they had a conversation about Ruby Bridges. And they were talking, and my son is a little older, Mosiah, and Messiah is a year younger. And they were talking about racism. And my son attempted to articulate to his cousin, who's only a year younger, about what racism is. And he says to him, man, it don't make sense to me either. And I'm sitting here blown away because these two 7-year-olds are attempting to have a conversation, the same conversation that we are at 30 and 40 and 50 and 60, yeah. And it still doesn't make sense to us. And so we don't separate the conversations in our house. When you walk through our house, you know, our house is like Dr. Hakeem Adubu, who said, you know, you want to know something about people, you look at what's on their walls, you look at what's in their
library.
What's on their library and what's in their refrigerator.
Yep.
Our children see Latin culture, African culture, Native American culture all through. And so we don't separate those conversations. We just came back from Tupelo, Mississippi. I was participating in a cultural conference, and we participated in two marches. It was a march against a shooting of a young brother. It was a Klan rally, and then it was a rally for this brother. And my son was just so blown away because, you know, we talk about this, but they saw me being pushed by the police. They saw my daughter being pushed. And he had a lot to talk about because he sees this every day. We don't separate the conversation based on age. You know, when you talk about sex and sexuality, that's a little different when you talk about age. When you talk about race and racism, they've had this conversation coming out of the womb that the world they were going to come into. And so they've been around these conversations. They've been on lectures. They've heard me speak. They've heard my wife speak. They've watched videos. And it's hard for them to sometimes to digest it. But I think it's important for us to continue to do what we do as I talk about in my book Ubuntu, which is that, you know, I am because you are and vice versa. But it's unfortunate that the sister said that she had to sort of walk away because her child looked a certain way and she didn't want people to think that she was, you know, this woman of color abusing or raising her voice at kids, because we do judge. And I think we got to have those conversations early. We can't candy coat it. We can't separate it. And it has to happen on a daily basis over the, you know, my children, we sit down and talk and we eat together every day. And we talk about these conversations. We talked about Tupelo. We talked about Memphis. I took them to the Dr. King Center.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just had Dr. King's barber,
yep,
Mr. Nelson.
Here.
My son, who gets it, walks up into the center. And he says, I want to tell the security guard that I just met Dr. King's barber, that he was just in my house. So my son gets it. He gets the
yeah.
connection.
Yeah.
And so we make a big deal of it. We have to sit down. Oh, let's have this conversation. No, let's just let it be a part of our daily life.
Well, then let's open a conversation up. Now that we've all kind of framed the way we talk about it, I will note that for my husband and I, you know, we did come into this conversation late. I mean, I'm kind of sandwiched between my dad, whose whole life was marked by the murder of Emmett Till and the work he did in the civil rights movement, and then my sons, you know, and the work they started doing after the murder of Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. Like, up until Trayvon Martin, they may even tell you that they had a different life. Yeah. I mean, you know, kind of in this sheltered environment, playing baseball, traveling, seeing the world, really thinking that if I just work hard enough, make enough money, put them in the academic environment, then some of the things that my dad talked about that maybe I didn't see very much in the 70s and 80s, that they won't see it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the murder of Trayvon Martin, for a lot of people like myself, it just pulled the wool completely off of our eyes, saying you can't make enough money to keep your kids safe. You can't have enough degrees to keep them safe. You've got to have these very real conversations, and it's not about safe sex. It's not about good. It's about, what do you do when the cops stop you?
Yeah.
I mean, very, very real. So then I just want to throw it out here. There was a 2014 study that said that black boys are perceived as being older and more threatening than they really are. So a 10-year-old is perceived to be almost 15 years old. We saw that in the case of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old, that the cops said he thought he was 20. So, you know, we have boys here. All of us do. So how do we combat the fact that black boys in particular are not even allowed to be kids?
Well, there's a similar study about African-American men who work in these white collar jobs, that that white folks feel threatened by these dark, tall African-American men who are making $300,000 a year. My buddy he talked about that. So that study, not only is it effective, Jermaine, to young people, it's also effective to men. You know, I get judged. I never throw my PhD or anything around. I want folks to introduce me, but I pull it out when I need to, when somebody tries to check and say, okay, who are you? And so again, you know, we have to teach our boys to be mindful of their entire surroundings. Mm-hmm. Our children would not, I'm from the South Side of Chicago. My son and daughter would never have that same experience, even though I take them back there and show them my hood, the body where I grew up. That's my experience. It's not their experience. But I want them to understand that the world that we live in is not fair. That as a boy of color, you have to work harder and harder and harder. You know, there's a song out that came out in the late, and I know the sisters want to say something, that came out in the late 90s by Bruce Springsteen. It was called 41 Shots. It's called American Skin. He attempted to sing that song on TV, on live TV. They turned off his monitor. It was about Amadou Diallo, who was shot 41 times.
He tells
a story about a woman named Lena who had every day had to get her African-American boy dressed. She got on her knees. She prayed. She says, if the police does this, you do that. And people in this world need to know that people of color, rich, be it rich or poor, every day we have to prepare our boys to go into a war. I don't care if they go to a private school or a public school, they're going to be judged.
Any environment.
And we don't want our boys to be victim and then to use it as a crutch to say, because I'm black, because I'm poor. No, I don't want the boys that are listening. I don't ever want you to use that as an excuse. I want you to use it as a reason to work harder. But we have to prepare our children, and folks of the other race need to be mindful. Yet this is what we have to do on a daily basis, just like we tell our girls.
Right.
You work harder than those boys. You run faster. The same thing we must tell our boys, to be mindful of that. But I want the boys to know, don't use it as a crutch or an excuse to not be successful.
Shamar, Memory, do you want to jump in here? Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, sure. One of the things I realize is that it takes a toll psychologically. That's one of the things. I have a master's degree in counseling, and that Dr. DeGruy, I've talked about post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a little bit about that?
Yes, and people, you know, did not believe his study, and now we're seeing the impact of it.
Yes. Yeah, and then it also, seeing what we see now, because my world is school, pre-K through post-secondary. That's the world that I study. That's the world that I've taught in. And I can understand now, I'm at this point, why black teachers were against desegregation, because they knew mm-hmm. what would happen to the bodies, the minds, and the spirits of their black children. I understand now why black social workers were against transracial adoption, because the hearts and the bodies and the minds of black children would suffer. It's very difficult to it's the reality, but we also have to figure out ways of putting in place self-care and being okay with, you know, this fight I'm not going to take on, mm-hmm. or today I'm just not going to be the educator of white society, or, you know, today I'm just not going to go to the grocery store because I get too many stares. Maybe I'll wait in the car while my friend goes, because I just can't deal with it today. And that it is okay to have those thoughts, because self-care is important.
Let me ask you, Shamar, as you come in here, because I think that's very, very real, this notion of self-care, or knowing when you need to step out for a moment, just step out of the whole fight to just mm-hmm. breathe. So how do you navigate this? I'm thinking, you said you're not too far from where Tamir Rice is killed. You're raising, you know, a son. Like, how do you as a mother deal with self-care? And then how do you teach this to your kids?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking me that. I want to agree with the folks that have already talked about all of the issues around parenting and these boys specifically during this time. So for me, I've really tried to model to my children, and I believe that being a good parent, for me, being a good mother means that I'm showing them that life is not all roses, that right. there's going to be good days and there are going to be bad days. And recently, a tactic that I was actually sharing with the young lady that I grew up with yesterday, I saw her out in the community, and our boys were playing, and we looked at each other and said, "Do you believe that this is our life?"
No.
We were those kids playing all those years ago.
Wow.
And so we began talking, and she has three boys, and I have two. And, you know, I told her, and she's she works for she's a prosecutor for the county here. And so she has a very demanding job. And so I said to her, sister to sister, I said, "You can take your 20 minutes when you come home from work." I said, "You have to teach your children that."
Yeah.
And especially with them being young men, right? It has to be modeled for them. They have to learn how to take care of us as black women. So telling them really quickly, and I had to do this with my children because they would meet me at the door.
Right.
I still got all my bags and everything. They meet me at the door. They want juice. They want a hug. They want to tell me about their fantastic day, and I want to hear about it. But in order to receive that, I need that 20 minutes for myself.
Yeah.
And I used to feel bad about it, right? So, like, as Dr. Maria was saying, I used to feel bad about it. Like, oh, I've been gone from my children all day. How am I supposed to take another 20 minutes for myself? They just want to be with me. But that's the healthy decision.
Right.
And so we have to begin making healthy decisions for ourselves, particularly for me as a black mother, but for all of us who gives care and love and concern, not just to our biological children, but to all of the children, right? So my research focuses on mother work, so understanding that it's a pedagogy.
Right.
So anyone can pick that pedagogy up and work with it and work to inspire young people and support them. So even if it's not your biological child, I think it's important that we model the way for them. We have to show them that when we have bad days, it's okay, and we can bounce back. We take the time that we need. We do what we need to take care of ourselves. And those of us in the generation that we're in right now, it's been really difficult for us to manage that line. I can speak to my generation, right? So I'm on the cusp between millennials and Gen X.
Right.
And I think it's been really difficult for us to tote that line because our parents and our foremothers didn't do such a good job. So it wasn't modeled to us. So right now, we are having the opportunity where we have to try it on and try it out. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But that's the lesson in it for our young people, is that we have the courage to stand up and try to live the life that was best for us and for them.
I'm glad Shamar talked about shutting down. You know, anytime a piece of technology is giving us problems, what's the first thing we do? We turn it off. And so we need to turn things off.
I want to ask you because that was my question to you. Because even if we turn the technology off, I turn my phone off.
Yeah.
My sons and daughters, as a whole, are still being bombarded every day with the images of another black body being assaulted. So you can turn the image off, but how do you turn it off once it gets
I'm talking about what Shamar said. I'm talking about shutting off from the world, and then, because you can't give what you don't have. And we're in the world where we're constantly giving and giving, and people are pulling and pulling and pulling. And so when I talk about the technology, I'm literally talking about that's what we normally do. When our technology is not working, we shut it down. Mm-hmm. We need to do that as individuals. We need, and our children need to see that it's okay to take a rest. It's okay to take a breather. One of the things that I've been teaching, and this whole thing of mindfulness, folks think it's new. We've been doing this for years, and mm-hmm. people of African descent have been doing it by far greater than other folks. But of course, some other folks do it that don't look like us. We think it's new. Even with all the boys I work with, they say, Dr. Shields, you can't get black and brown boys to sit down for 5 or 10 minutes. I work with two groups of black and Latino boys. And before we start anything, we do mindfulness. We meditate for 5 minutes. Now, of course, the little boys, they acting goofy. They act like they some yogis and they holding their fingers crossed. I can tolerate that. They looking at me. I'm looking at them. Their eyes supposed to be closed. But I'm showing them that we need to be in the moment. And the word present is a gift. It means to be in the moment. And our children, and Shamar said it, we have to pull back into ourselves. It took me a while to get that from my wife when she would just go in the bathroom for 20 minutes, lock the door, and have the music. It took me a while because I was being like, listen, you need to get out here. We got kids to raise. We ain't got time to be shutting down for 20 minutes. But I saw when she came back out, she was a totally different person. So I had to be mindful of that as well, as Carol Dweck talks in her book, The Mindset, being mindful of pouring back into yourself. And we don't do that enough. And our children need to see it. And we need to get them, now going back to the technology,
right,
we need to get them to cut that thing off.
Right.
We need to be in the moment, be in the present moment. At dinner tables, that thing is off. You know, we do this thing called roses and thorns. And I want any parent to try this because people say boys don't talk. This is what I normally do with young people. Roses and thorns. I say to your son, what's your son's name again?
Kofi Anamia.
So Kofi, I don't ask Kofi, how was your day today? Because you ain't going to get a whole lot from him. It's like, mm-hmm. how was the movie? I said, Kofi, I want you to tell me what your rose was. And so his rose was, you know, I scored a high score. I dunked a basketball. You know, this girl liked me. I passed the test. So what's your thorn? Then the thorn is, you know, I fell down the stairs. I got a bad grade. So I'm teaching them how to articulate, because mommy wants roses. She doesn't want thorns. So we have to come up with strategies to get our boys to talk, because we know, as the research say, boys have a very limited emotional vocabulary. So what do? Is we have to help them. In a world where it's ran by women, y'all use a lot of words to say one thing. Men are very, very specific. Not Pacific. That's a body of water. We're very specific. And with women, boys tell me, Dr. Shields, can you get the teachers to stop giving me so many directions? So I say you need to talk in bullets, because boys' minds are like the spinners on a car. You know, when a car stops, mm-hmm. the rims will keep moving. And the ladies on the phone, they know your son's head is constantly moving. So you got to be mindful when you give them directions, and you got to have them repeat back what you want them to say. You send me upstairs to get your purse. You know that purse ain't where you said it is, but I come downstairs with something I've been looking for years, and you mad at me. I'm like, Mom, well, you need to go up there and get the purse yourself, because it ain't never where you told me it is. So as I'm walking up the stairs, I forgot everything that you wanted me to do. And so because our boys are wired, see, some of y'all thinking about your husbands now, why they don't remember what you guys said. So we got to be mindful how we engage our young people.
Well, we're going to take a break, and we got to come back, because I definitely have some comments for Dr. Lamar about this. I'm Dr. K, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show. We have to take a break, but don't go away. When we come back, I'll continue our conversation, Parenting in the Age of Black Lives Matter. Welcome back. I'm Dr. K, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show, your source for cool jazz and more WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are continuing our parenting roundtable to discuss parenting in the age of Black Lives Matter. How should we talk to our kids about race, and how can we keep them safe? We have Shamar Arkey on the phone with us. She's an educator, activist, organizer, and a mother of two. Thank you for staying with us. We have Dr. Marie Nubia Feliciano on the phone with us from Chapman University. She's also the mother of two. And Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields is in the studio with us. He's the author of What I Learned in the Midst of Chaos. He's also a father, but he has two girls and a boy. Good. So we want to pick up of what Dr. Lamar was saying when we went to break. He was saying with boys, you know, kind of keeping things simple, speaking in bullet points. They don't have this kind of intensive vocabulary. I would actually disagree with that. My boys are intensive readers. We didn't have a television when they were growing up. We don't have one now. And they spent time at the library reading and reading and reading. They have a very complicated vocabulary, and they don't like when I make things simple. Mm-hmm. When I try to give them the simple explanation, when I give them simple directions, they want
not more, the library. I'm talking about emotional vocabulary.
I like that. They have that. But we've been
working
on building that emotional vocabulary.
That's good.
I mean, you talk about directions. Like, you know, if you send them upstairs to get your purse, for example. I mean, you know, the purse thing. But even from when they were young children, I would say, hey, we're going to school this morning. I don't know how to get there.
Yeah, see, you are very mindful.
Yeah.
You're very mindful. But when you look at the research of boys, many of them get in trouble for not following directions. The teachers ask them, why did you do that? They say they don't know. We ask them about emotions, because the world that we live in is about using these hands. As they said to Malcolm X when he was a kid, use your hands. And because the world is dominated by the feminization of education, most of the educators are females. The
right.
way, you know,
yeah,
you know,
Sadek,
Dr. Sadek said boys and girls sitting in the same classroom, listening to the same lesson. They get a different type
Two
of education.
Things.
And so it's not to say that boys don't have a vocabulary, but we talk about the emotional vocabulary. So boys somewhat shut down when you think of the film Antoine Fisher, which is probably the best research film of how boys are engaged. You talk about this lack of a very emotional vocabulary. My son is very different too. That's because I was very mindful of
it.
And see, it's a difference. But when you look at on a large scale, even if you and I were in a relationship together, we were high school students, you say, Lamar, how do you feel about me? And I say, you go first. You give me all these metaphors, but then I say, you cool, you straight. Think about your boyfriend. So you thinking now. You thinking. And so again, it's because we teach girls, you know, we teach girls to use a language. And then if you go even deeper with the research, and when you talk about poverty, as the more money a person makes in a certain area, that even goes deeper.
Whole thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
the vocabulary is even heightened
yes.
when it sort of comes to that.
Well, let me bring Mr. Shamar and Marie in here, because the study that Lamar is talking about, one of the places that talks about it, just in short, is in Malcolm Gladwell's book.
Yes.
He just kind of talks about this research that he noticed when you look at the homes of people who are economically challenged versus, you know, middle income and higher, that they speak to their children very differently.
Yes.
Whereas when someone who's, you know, economically challenged take their child to the doctor, they typically say, shut up and listen to the doctor and do
yes.
what the doctor says.
Yes.
And they noticed when they went with parents who were middle income and higher, they would say things like, we're going to see your doctor.
Indeed.
Tell your doctor what's wrong with you. Speak up for yourself. If your doctor does something and makes you uncomfortable, mm-hmm. say something to your doctor. Teaching them very early on how to advocate for themselves. How did you do this, Shamar, with your kids?
So this is something that we are working on right now. Like you said, with things like at the doctor, at the restaurant, ordering their own food. You know, so they have to be able to take care of themselves as young men in this world. And I'm not too familiar with the study that you all are referencing with Malcolm Gladwell. But in my own research, you know, I've done a lot of research on curriculum development. And I studied a lot of bell hooks and the difference between education and schooling. And I think that those studies are based on how we school our kids,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're looking at it through this very white supremacist hegemonic structure of how we're giving out the information. So I think that when we dismantle that structure, when we have conversations with our children, my boys are 6 and 9, and I sit down and I talk to them about my research, and they shoot back words at me like apparently and inadequately, and I'm like, wait a minute. Like, they're telling me that the water in the water gun was inadequate to shoot far across the grass or something. And I'm just like, who do you belong to? And then I realize that they belong to me. Because, I mean, we live together in this home, so we create community.
Right.
And I'm getting my dissertation done right now. So those of you who've been through that, you know, that's my whole life.
We're sending you some prayers, sister.
Yes, we are.
And I think that it's really important that we have to give our young people, specifically our boys, again, it comes with modeling the way.
Right.
Like, I do have to make it down on his level, but I don't dumb it down for him.
Right.
Right. Right. Because I'm still using the same vocabulary. And I think it's important that we have to allow our children to rise to the expectations and to the occasions that we set for them. We have to give them an opportunity. We give them all of this information, but then we as parents have got to step back and allow them to do the work for themselves. We have to provide that context for them, be there to support them and to scaffold them for success, but we have to give their young people an opportunity to begin to have these conversations with their friends. Like, I remember I took the neighbor and my son to a Kwanzaa celebration a couple years ago, and in the backseat of the car, as Dr. Lamar was talking about, they were talking about ancestors, and they were explaining to one another who their ancestors were, and they were trying to figure out if Michael Jackson was one of their ancestors. You know? And so it was just, I mean, so they are so profound if we just give it to them and right. we let them do it in their own way.
Marie, what about you?
Yeah. Community.
Well, oh, I'm sorry, Shamar. Marie, what do you think?
No.
Well, for me, it's actually bouncing between a couple of cultures. In the Latino community, there's more modeling and more declarative talk to children. It's like, you do this, you go here, you come and do this. And then we model things. Like if my child wants to do something, I don't necessarily talk them through it, I show them. And I was actually at a job talk at another institution I was working at, and a woman was part of her research was looking at Mexican mothers and how they educate their children. There's a lot, they sit them next to them or sitting next to the other women that are doing something, and the child is expected to watch, learn, and model.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Mexican mothers there. Then she looked at Mexican mothers that immigrated with their children here, and they maintained a little bit of that kind of passing on, the way of passing on education. But then they realized that the children are now in U.S. schools, and so the children were pushing back against that Mexican way of teaching. And we're asking their moms to talk more. And
right.
it frustrated them because the child was becoming bilingual and the mothers were doing that at a slower pace. And then the second generation of moms who had gone to school here and now raising their kids, they talk to their kids all the time. And this is what you do, and this is what you do. And I realized that is I'm at the point where I fit in where I was born in Vieques. I grew up in Calabria, one of the two smaller islands in Puerto Rico.
Wow.
I hardly ever show up on the map, on any map. And then I come here, and I've gone through the education system, but I see the value of just sitting
right.
and watching. And I do that, and I try to do that. But I understand that the children need to, order for themselves, talk with the doctor, but it's reluctant. I keep myself back because of the way I feel like I need to model so that the children can see, but I don't want to disempower them and have them not develop their voice for when I'm gone,
right.
because this is the world they're living in. They're
right.
not living back in Puerto Rico or Calabria. They're living here.
Right here.
And so I'm struggling with that, but it is something that, for me, it's a multicultural, because we're also multilingual. The, mm-hmm. the kids speak Spanish because I only speak to them in Spanish. And so translating all of that, all the cultural norms, and then translating them back into English so that they fit here, I'm trying to help them do that
right.
because I see that they're fits and stops and the struggles. And then getting back to the topic of this talk is like Black Lives Matter. I have to help them understand what that means, not just in the Black context of the African-American United States, but in the African diasporic concept
right.
of what it means to be Black in the Puerto Rican sense, and just how that those two things go back and forth in me, and why I struggle, and then in them, why they're struggling to understand me and then understand their own reality.
Well, let's
really
get some calls.
Exhausting.
No, it is exhausting. I mean, it is this dance that we do as parents, as activists, as researchers. All of this comes into the house. But I want to get some callers involved. Donna, you've been holding a while. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Hello.
And I'm congratulating all your parents. I never had children. I'm married, but I never had children. However, I've helped raise a lot of my girlfriend's children and, and nieces and nephews, and I mentor a lot of young people. So, when you look at different generations, there is a disconnect on how parents raise their children.
Right.
I look at my older who are in there, now they're in their 70s. They were the first generation, a couple years born into the baby boom group. And I had a friend, she stunned me when she said, I told my daughters that there were no good Black men, so you had to marry white men. So, and she will deny she said it, but I remember she told my daughters to marry white men and, whatever. Then I have another girlfriend. I have a lot of older friends, and I see them, how they think at different levels and when they were born. And so the middle group of the baby boomers, she taught her sons that Black people were no good as well, and that whites were better. So you have to have white friends. You have to, And her sons now are finding out in their 30s the truth And it's a shame that they had to find out, because she did not have those conversations that your guests have. Then I looked at the tail end group. I'm the tail end group and the Generation X's. And we're a little different, because I tell people in a second, I'm a radical. I don't believe, I mean, because my parents taught me about our African self. I mean, they got us the book. You remember, I'm not sure if any of you remember that Negro history book that came out, the volume. It was a, probably don't.
I remember my father used to have it on the shelf.
Right. My parents did too. And that was that, you know, that educated me, and they got me a lot of, you know. And then I went to Morgan, and I learned African history, and having multicultural. I had professors from all over, you know, from all over the world. And so I learned, I always considered Morgan an international school, because you had everybody, you know, whatever. But my point is.
So did you have a question, Donna? Because I love the comments about the different ways with your experience and the different ways of parenting. But did you have a quick comment for our guest?
A quick question or comment is,
okay.
Dr. Raymond Wimbush put it a better way in his book, that we have to teach our history. And my question is, and I guess my concern is, when you go into the trenches of the poor black communities, they don't have the women,
right.
The single mothers don't have this conversation. And when we have, like, Christian camp schools for the kids, they're asking the same questions. Well, why white people hate us? Why, you know, so they're asking questions, and they're not getting the answer from their community. So they come into the churches and the camps asking those questions.
Okay. So why don't we take that up? So let me come to you, Lamar. This notion of trying to create this sense of community, sense of classroom, sense of learning at all times, for not just our own kids. We're talking about for any children that we come in contact
with. Yeah, one of the things that I'm mindful of, I'm on a road at least 100 times out of the year. When I leave, my children always have an assignment. If I'm going to a particular state, I tell them to find out the capital of that state. When I come back, tell me a couple of famous people of color who are from there, or something historic. We just came back from Mississippi. As we were driving back from Mississippi, we stopped at Ida B. Wells' house.
Okay.
And I wanted them to understand who Ida B. Wells was. I went to Tupelo. I wanted them to see Elvis's house. While I went to Elvis' house, they heard me quote the infamous Chuck D.
Yes.
Well, from 1989, and you know, fight the power.
So I
got to give a little respect to Elvis, but then I got to let them know, be real clear, Elvis stole Little Richard's music, but that's another conversation. So everything about us is natural. It's like being a vegan. I'm a vegan. It's a lifestyle. It's not something I do. And so it's in every breath. I love people. I love people of color. Listen to my Latin sister on here. I know the struggle of, you know, she's from Vieques. I done fought in Vieques for the Navy to get out of Vieques in Culebra. I know the struggle of her trying to understand it. And even in Puerto Rico, that, you know, you still have race.
Right.
The white Puerto Ricans are still in power. The folks from Bayamon and Catalina, where my folks are, you know, they don't have the power. So I understand that she is dancing on this fence, you know, to go back and forth. I listen to the sister Shamar talk about her sons, talk about Michael Jackson being an ancestor. Our children are getting it. But what I want the people out there who don't have the degrees that we have, I want them to be real clear, because somebody's judging us because we have our degrees, because we moved on. What we're talking about does not take, you don't have to go to college to have a conversation with your son or with your daughter. You can talk to them in a car while they're driving. You can ask them their thoughts and their opinion. The difference from our generation, our grandparents, they didn't ask us anything. We had to sit there, be quiet, and listen. This is a generation that want to be involved. So it's incumbent upon the individuals that are listening, have the conversations, ask them opinions, be mindful, be attentive, be excited about what they're talking about. Even if you ain't interested in what they're talking about, just listen to them. You don't have to have a college degree to ask them, so how do you feel about Donald Trump? How do you feel about, you know, the mayor? How do you feel about police brutality? And listen to them and just, you know, but don't have an opinion all the time, but just be open and listen to what they have to say, because our children will not get our experiences. They're not going to understand what it was like growing up on the South Side of Chicago. They're not going to understand what it's like growing up without a father. My kids will never know that. They will not know those things, but they hear me talking about it. And I never complain about where I came from. Those were lessons. Those were lessons that I learned. And so we got them. We take these trips. We got to have these cultural trips. We got to take them to the Jewish museum, the Islamic museum, this museum. We got to have these conversations. When we go on field trips, or when we take our children we take them to vacation. We just take them to Disney World and that's it. We take them to King's Dominion. That's it. Each city that we take these children to, not just mine, but other children, expose them to other things.
Well, then let me
different
just
foods and different like well, my kids let love a variety of food as
let,
well.
Let me throw something out because I want to get Marie and Shamar in here because I just got a direct message from someone who's actually commenting on what Dr. Lamar just said, that this sounds like these are these middle class ideas.
Yeah.
You're taking your kids around the country. You have the time. You're traveling. What about those of us who don't have this kind of money? You said talk to our kids when we're driving. She's like, well, what if you don't have a car? So Marie, what else can parents do? Taking it away from these bigger things of taking them to Tupelo, Mississippi, which I think is wonderful, and I love doing that with my boys. But what if you can't do that? How do you make these spaces open to have these conversations?
Well, we try to create a low-tech world in our, you know, in getting looping back to the conversation we had a little bit about technology. My children don't have access to it. We've actually opted them out of school as well because we are trying to let their brains develop. Mm-hmm. There's neurocognitive benefits to that. And so, well, what do we have? We have an encyclopedia at home. We have access to the library. And so when they ask something, it's like, well, go look it up.
Okay.
And then tell me. Tell me what you found out, and then I'll let you know from what I know from my own background in education, what I know about it. And then we'll have a conversation, we'll have questions, and we'll look further. And then when we've hit the limit of what we either one of us can contribute to a conversation, then we go to the computer in the office.
Okay.
And that's when. So there's... But if you don't have a computer, that's a really good conversation because it gets them talking. And then they can go to school and ask their teacher or go to the school's library if the school has a library. There's resources. One of the, you know, when we came from Vieques to Carson, we were sort of like, you know, just picture a black family coming clear across an entire nation. And I mean, there was nothing. But we had a dictionary in the house, and my mom says, you know, every time we say, how do you spell this? It's like, go look it up.
Go look it up. So I like that low-tech idea. I want to get a couple more callers in here.
And no
June
TV.
Is,
TV.
Definitely no TV. June is calling from New York City. Good morning, June.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for joining us. You had a comment about intersectionality?
I do. I've really enjoyed this morning's lively interaction. My question is around our conversations, especially in the wake of Black Lives Matter, around creating monoliths of experience for particular groups of people, men and women, Black folks, people, Black and brown folks, and white people. And so my question for folks is around intersectionality and when and where do we have those conversations where we invite our students to look at what it means to be Black and trans or to be Asian and queer and an artist, right? So all of these things that are at odds with the monolith that we've created, and especially in Black Lives Matter, because this is the time for us to, in order to dismantle the master's house, perhaps we don't need tools, perhaps a new way of thinking and a paradigm shift.
Thank you so much, June. Shamar, I'm going to come straight to you. So what do you think? How do we do this? How do we have these conversations around intersectionality, the places and the points where all these things come together?
Right. Thank you for coming back to me. And thank you, Joan, for your call. I really appreciate that question. A part of my research really focuses on just that, right? And so if you guys are on Twitter, you can look me up. My handle on Twitter is Black, Femme. And there's a hashtag called Black, Feminine. And it speaks to that intersectionality. So as I began my research working with other mothers in the community, how we identify ourselves and our roles and responsibilities are really important. And so in my research, I placed that comma between the Black and feminist, because even with those two identities and roles, some might see that as being incongruent. Some might say, oh, well, if you're Black, you should be a womanist, or you should be a different type of feminist. And we're seeing this more and more even in our casual conversations. Like, I know you guys have seen those websites that sell those T-shirts that say, I love Jesus and trap music, right? Right. Those are the contradictions. Those are the intersections.
Kay is wearing one right now.
Right. Those are the intersections that we live in. And that, like, that's fun and that's cute to put on a T-shirt, right? But that's my real life.
Right.
And so as you guys were talking about, you know, the caller came in about the question around middle class values. So I have not completed my degree yet. So I'm a full-time student, and I am a mom, and I'm out here trying to hustle, right? Lester Spence wrote this book talking about knocking the hustle. So
So I think when we talk about middle class values and we kind of assign it to that category, that kind of lets people off the hook a little bit.
Right.
And what I really want to say is, it's something that you want. And those of us who know, who come from oppressed and marginalized communities, we have to hustle to get what we want. Mm-hmm. And if you want your children to have those opportunities, then you have to hustle.
Yeah.
I just got back from the library this weekend where I could get a bag of books for $4. I bought my kids an unabridged dictionary and a world atlas. So those are things that are in my house for my children. And it's not that it's a middle class value. It's about me being at the library all the time, right? Seeing the signs and making it a point to go back and making it a point to show those to my children. It's about me as a mom who's a full-time student without a steady income calling camps so that my 9-year-old can have an experience at summer camp. Because if I want to prepare him for that independent school that he's going to apply to this year, because I know that that's the best education that he can get, he's not going to Paris. He's not going to Cayman Islands. We're not doing that.
No,
but
right.
He went to summer camp. He got an opportunity to ride a horse. He got an opportunity to zip line. I have to create those experiences for my children so that they can compete in that world out there. And so I don't think it's about having these middle-class values. I think it's about connecting with our spirit, connecting with our internal mother work, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can connect with Yemoja. We can take it all the way back to the African goddess, right? We have to be able to connect with that to get the strength and the fortitude that we need to prepare our children for battle.
And I'm so glad you said that. You know, you're either attracting or repelling according to your mental attitude. You either identify yourself with lack or abundance, with love or indifference. And we got to stop coming from this mode of lack of what we don't have. And the reality is, if your children are a priority, you are going to make it happen. Today's field trip with the Shields kids, when I get off the radio, is we're going to the Walters Art Museum because they have an African exhibit, and my kids are going, and it's free.
Well,
living in D.C., you know, there are tons of things that you can do for free. Of course, I'm mentioning the trips that we just took because those were paid trips, and I got the opportunity to take the kids. But we got to stop using excuses and then get mad because I'm unapologetic African. I'm unapologetic, a cat from the hood who loved Latin and African music, grew up with a single mom. But I don't never use that as no excuse. And I don't have to keep wearing it on my shoulder to let people know, because I ain't made it until we've all have made it. But what I want people that come from disparate communities, my black and brown people and my poor white folks, to understand that there's so many opportunities right under your nose to hear this sister say, we got a dictionary in the house, that we have an encyclopedia. Cats don't even know what an encyclopedia is. Every day my youngest son, has to look up a word, and every day he has to use that word. That don't require a whole lot. He doesn't pull out his phone to look this up. It's an old school dictionary that I got from the dollar store that gave it to him because I want him to expand his vocabulary.
Exactly.
So the moment that we keep using these excuses and we keep talking about a lack, you become who you are and what you think about all day long. And so we got to change our mindset first, and then everything else will sort of fall right behind it.
I want to just follow up quickly about what you said, the Walters Museum, because we have Lewis on the phone, and Lewis just had a question about how he can increase visits to black museums. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about that for a second? You just said you're taking your kids to the Walters. Today.
Yeah, my thing is, so you know, I'm in Baltimore and DC is right next door. I mean, we're always going to the Smithsonian, the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. If you're a teacher, you get a free membership. If you're a kid, then I forgot what that is. I'm always encouraging people to get memberships at these museums because it increases, you know, the value of the organization. I'm constantly taking kids to the museum. You know, we, of course, I expose my kids to Latin art, and I explain to them what these artists are doing, and artists across the country. Art is important in our family. Music is really important. So taking them to the museum, but don't make it boring. Give them a scavenger hunt. You know, come up with some questions and answers before they get there. Don't wait for the people to give you the whack scavenger hunt. Make it fun. You know, compare it to something that's culturally relevant. A lot of stuff is culturally irrelevant to our children, so they don't want to be a part of it. Compare some of the art today to some of the art of yesterday. But then it's really just taking them, getting on a bus, getting on a library. When we go to D.C., we jump on the train. We take the train. We walk. We take them to the halls of Congress. We walk them around. We talk about the history of that. So, again, there's so many free things. You can go online. Every day I go online and Google, what are some free events in Baltimore, in Chicago, wherever I'm going, to look those things up. But the library will take you places that even a plane can't even take you to. So getting your kid a library card is very, very. And then the last thing is service. At the Praise Academy, our boys are required to volunteer, and we only focus on these men centers because we want the young men to see the possibility of what could happen to them if they don't make the right choices. So service once a month with your children is very, very important. Reading to them, especially reading to your boys, getting them to read is very, very important. And then increasing level. And we're talking about boys, I know. I mean, right, it can be the same thing with girls as well. But again, you know, taking them to this and then allowing them to see you. This sister talked about working on her doctorate. Her children are going to be mindful of what she's doing because they're watching mommy read. They're watching her struggle. Exactly. They're watching her go through this. And she's probably going back and forth with them. They're probably going to be her dissertation committee. Two kids don't even know it. They in there learning because they're gonna try to tell you apart, and can't nobody tell you apart like your family. Yeah. So you use your kids as your dissertation team.
Yeah, but for finding what? I mean, I just want to throw out that when I was working on my dissertation and we did not have money, I'm like Shamar, we did not have money. Well, we made our own art museum. I had them sit down, you color, let's get some, you know, some really cheap frames, let's put it on our walls and walk through like we're walking through a museum. Let's critique our own art. Like there are ways that we can make this possible. I have two DMs that just came through. People are asking for solutions. So we don't have much time, but I'm going to ask specific questions if we can quickly go around, and we'll start with you, Marie. Just well, they want to know what to do. What do you tell your kids when the cops stop them?
To be respectful and listen.
Okay, Shamar?
Tell them that they need to call their mom.
Need to call their mom. Lamar?
I would Google my buddy David Miller. He has 10 rules of survival if stopped by the police. Just Google David Miller, 10 rules of survival if stopped by the police. But they said the same thing, being mindful, being respectful, because the police wants to get home safe and our children want to get home safe. But definitely Google David Miller, 10 rules of survival if stopped by the police.
How about when a fight breaks out on the playground, Lamar?
Well, you know, you got to be mindful of your surroundings. You got to make sure that you're safe. You got to make sure the people around you are safe. It's almost like bullying. If you feel comfortable going in, breaking up the fight, with starting with your words first and then separating individuals, then you do that. But I always say finding an adult on the playground, someone that's respectful, an adult that's going to listen to you, bring them to the table, and then, being mindful of that is really, because we want our children to be safe. But then, of course, finding an adult, I think, is the best thing to do.
Shamar, black boys are at a higher rate, as well as black girls, of being either suspended or expelled. So what do you tell your kids? What do you do when the teachers, when they say teachers are picking on me, or they're being put out of class, what should they do?
I tell them that they have to create their own agency. So I tell them they have to be respectful, but their number one priority is being safe. So if they don't feel safe, then they have an opportunity to protect themselves. And if that means getting up and leaving the class and going to see someone else in the school who's safe, then that's what they have to do, because their safety is number one.
Marie, what should they do when they're being followed in the store?
Because my children can pass for white, they aren't. I'm the one that usually am. And so what I'm trying to figure out is how to help them become white passing allies for not only their mother, but for other friends that they have.
Oh, thank you so much. We're going to leave that there. This is Dr. K sitting in for Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show. I want to thank you so much, Shamar Arkey, educator and activist and organizer and doctoral student at Northeastern University. Her work is Mother Work in the Age of Black Lives Matter. She is on Twitter. Thank you so much, Dr. Marie Nubia Feliciano. She's a professor at the College of Educational Studies at Chapman University. Thank you for joining us. And, of course, to our homegrown, Dr. Lamar Darnell Shills, co-founder and senior director of education and innovation at the Cambia Group. Also, you can pick up his book, What I Learned in the Midst of Chaos. You take a look and Google him, because he's doing a lot around this city, particularly around with black boys and the Praise Group. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's show to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. As your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM is the voice of the community. And this has been The Mark Steiner Show, and this is Dr. K. Let this be the time that you speak out and speak up. Your silence will not protect you, shield you, or cover you. Someone has got to change the world. Why not start with you? Thank you so much.